Well, first of all, thank you, Siv, for inviting me, and I always like to come to the Fields Institute because it's such a great facility, and also come to Toronto to visit my colleague Hwashan Huang, who's here. We're not quite sure what's going on here. Okay. And a visitor, Hwashan's visitor, Wei Yao, who is sitting right here in the front. So they're both here to make sure that what I say is correct. These are other collaborators I've had. This is actually my PhD student at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. Yuching Wang was my postdoc at UBC, University of British Columbia, who then saw the light and went into financial engineering, and is now working for the Royal Bank of Canada. Ben Steinberg was here in the medical school at University of Toronto. I'm not sure where he is. I don't know. I don't know where he is either. Yeah, maybe he's out practicing medicine. Hideo Ikeda was a visitor of mine. He's from Japan. Nongsheng there was my PhD student who also left academia and has been doing a variety of consulting jobs and presently is consulting for the FDA in the United States. And Henry Tuckwell is the person who actually got me involved in this project on spreading depression, not on migraine with aura. At that time, it wasn't really known that that was a connection. And Henry Tuckwell is still very active and presently is in one of the Max Planck Institutes in Leipzig. So what I'm going to tell you about today is migraine with aura, and this is supposed to be a catchy title, but it'll be a lot duller than the title, I'm sorry to say. But let me tell you a little bit about migraine and about the aura. So migraine, if you've never had it, I've never had it as well, but people who have had it describe it as a very painful type of headache, and it's very common from a lot of people. I'm sure you have friends who say they have migraine. You probably also know have friends who say they have migraine with aura. And so I'll describe a little bit about it today. So the pain can be excruciating and may incapacitate people for hours and even up to days. Some people say it's so severe they just want to find a quiet place, dark place, to just lay down and not be bothered. Some are very sensitive. The people are very sensitive to light and sound. They can become nauseated and vomit. It's three times more common in women than in men. This also has been substantiated in experimental mice, where female mice the threshold for spraying depression is much lower than for male mice. And although there's still no cure, there are apparently some medications that you can take to reduce it or even eliminate some of the pain. So that's migraine in general. And migraine is very prevalent in society. Aura is less prevalent. Aura occurs in about 20% of the people who have migraine. And these people have a precursor to their migraine headache. And so they have some warning that this is going to happen to them. And the precursor, in many cases, will be some sort of visual hallucination or some illusion that they see, and it's called an aura. So this is something you see in your visual field. It's not actually something outside, it's something in your brain that's happening. And there are a variety of forms of this aura. If you look on the web, there are actually simulations of what some of these look like, and I'll show you a couple of examples. They could be flashes of light. They could be zigzag patterns. They sometimes are called fortification patterns that propagate in your visual field and then disappear, and then you get this headache. And there are blind spots that can occur in your visual field. You can get temporary vision loss after one of these things happen. Okay, now what's happened? Hold on a second. Okay. So this is an example of what was drawn, and this is from a very old book, 1845. So this has been around for a long time, and probably even longer than this. And people have, scientists have actually started to see what this pattern looks like, and this is an example of presumably someone's aura, and they drew it as they saw it. I don't know what's causing this problem. Okay. Now, Lashley is probably the first scientist that has really given this some scientific thought. Lashley, in 1941, made suggestions about connecting some propagating cerebral phenomenon, some propagating thing in the brain, to the visual aura. So the visual aura comes from the visual cortex, which is in your occipital lobe in the back. And what happens is that presumably spreading depression moves in the visual cortex, and as it's moving in the visual cortex, then you see these things that you think are in front of you but are in fact coming from your brain. And so this is an example that Lashley drew. This is what's called a fortification pattern, and so these are like jagged lines, and these are at different times, and I suspect these are in minutes. And he also took the pattern that he saw and translated them into the visual cortex. And this is sort of his translation into the visual cortex. Lashley actually...
Induced himself to have a migraine?
I'm sorry?
Was he inducing himself to have a migraine?
No. He actually had these. He was one of these people who had these kind of auras. I don't know whether he actually had the migraines as well. I suspect he did, but Lashley's actually an interesting person. He's a neuropsychologist, lived quite a long time ago, but he has a Canadian connection because one of his students is Donald Hebb. Donald Hebb is known for the Hebb theory of connection of cells and strengthening of connection between cells by activity. Is anybody here? Who is a Mac user here? Nobody here is a Mac user? I don't know what keeps causing that. What's wrong? You're a Mac user. I see. Okay. Okay, so that's migraine with aura. And I haven't told you very much about the clinical side because I don't know a whole lot about the clinical side. Now, cortical spreading depression, some people just call it spreading depression, is a phenomenon which consists of propagating chemical waves in the brain. And so here's an example. This is supposedly half of a rat brain, looking at it from the top. And you put a stimulus here, and as a consequence, there are waves of spreading depression that propagate outwards from it. And it looks like a target pattern. Now, there are a variety of stimuli that can produce this. You can put on potassium chloride, you can give it an AC current input, you can give it a DC current input, you can actually touch it and produce this phenomenon. It occurs in a variety of different structures, including the cerebral cortex, the visual cortex that I just showed you, the hippocampus. The retina is interesting because you can take a chick retina, so this is, you take the eyeball out, and you can actually induce a spreading depression wave, and you can see it. You can actually physically see it because it has a change of color. It occurs in a variety of animals, rabbit, cat, rat, and human. And there are a lot of questions as to why it's there or how people get it, and that's not known today. From a functional point of view, it depends on who you happen to be as to how you treat this. For physiologists who are doing experiments, this is a nuisance because a lot of times they'll be doing an experiment, they actually touch the cortex at a given location and generate one of these waves. The problem with that is that it takes a long time for this thing to go away. So you have to wait and wait and wait until this goes away. Then you get a clean cortex and you can start all over again. Psychologists have used this for learning and behavior. You can take an animal and implant a what's called a cannula on the top of the head, and you can stimulate a certain location of the brain. And so the animal is running around, you can stimulate it, and then try to teach it something. And if this wave is propagating over the brain, it turns out that that region of the brain we're traveling over is essentially like a dead piece of brain. It's not functioning. So the word depression here is not depression like psychological depression, it's depression of the electroencephalogram. The electroencephalogram normally is the activity between two separate locations in the brain surface. And so what happens is that when this wave goes by, that activity essentially goes to zero. So it looks like a dead brain. So from their point of view, they can try to teach an animal something. If it doesn't learn the particular task you're trying to teach it, then presumably that's where the spreading depression wave is located. Physicians, of course, they're interested in migraine with aura. This used to be called classic migraine, if you know it by that previous name. And there are a lot of people, of course, interested in headache in general. So when I say it's spreading in the brain, this is a section of the brain. And so this is the surface of the brain. And this area here is called gray matter. And it's pretty thin. It's on the order of millimeters. And the spreading depression wave actually goes along that cortex. This is the cortex part, the gray matter of the cortex, the outer surface. And these are called sulci, the sulcus. The brain goes infolds, and a lot of these waves can be generated in one part of the brain, propagates, and then sometimes it'll go around, but generally it will stop at these sulci. So when people do experiments on these, on this particular phenomenon, they try to choose an animal that has basically a flat surface, so then you don't have these sulci. So. Well, it's also unethical to do it in humans anyway, so if you can do it with an animal, it's better. Okay. Now, it's interesting from a variety of point of views. The initial reason I got interested in this is because it reminded me of action potentials. If you know anything about neurophysiology, you know that action potentials are propagating waves in the nerves. So when I think I have a thought here, and I want to move my finger, there's an action potential going from my brain to my finger. Okay? And so from the point of view, though, of trying to understand this phenomenon, there are a variety of things you have to worry about. One is, how does it get started in the first place? How do you instigate this? That, we believe, is actually different from the propagation part. And so the main interest has been in the propagation. Okay? And I'll say a little bit about this instigation today, however. If you look at the wave, this is an experimental record. This is time, and this is 1 minute. And this is extracellular potassium. Now, extracellular potassium in normal brain will almost never go above about 11 millimolar. So, here you can see that this goes from about 5 millimolar, goes up to 32. And in some of the records I'll show you today, you can get things going up to 40, 50, 60, 70 millimolar. They're very large increases and very pathological increases. And then it recovers back to where it was before. But this recovery takes on the order of 1 to 3 minutes. So it's a very slow phenomenon. Travels on the order of 1 to 15 millimeters per minute, which is a long time, very long time. And the time in space scales related to action potential is very different. Where we're talking about seconds and minutes, action potentials are on the order of milliseconds. And here we're talking about scales that are on probably centimeters. Action potentials may be on the order of centimeters as well because of their speed, but anyway, the kind of space scales that we're talking about and the time scale we're talking about are really different from action potentials. Furthermore, the wavelength is large relative to cell size. That's going to be important for part of the modeling that I'm going to talk about today. So this is on the order of centimeters. The brain has on the order of 10 to the 11th cells, neurons. And so we're talking about scales that are very large compared to the number of cells or the cell sizes themselves. Cell sizes are on the order of microns, 10 to 100 microns. So this is extracellular potassium. This is extracellular calcium. And this picture is here because of a specific model that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. Now, how about the two things together? Well, for many years, it was thought that maybe there was a connection between migraine with aura and cortical spread and depression. And that was actually confirmed in 2001 by Hajikani et al. And this is work that's done in this Michael Moskowitz lab at Mass General Hospital at Harvard Medical School. So they made a very strong connection between these two phenomena. It's still conjecture because, you know, they can't say this is specifically that when you see an aura, this is exactly a spreading cortical depression wave. But the kind of things they saw were the following. First of all, they used the functional MRI, and they had continuous recordings during the with three patients. And so one of these patients, these were all three males, one of these patients could induce a migraine or aura by doing exercise. So they told him to go out and play basketball for, I don't know, for half an hour or an hour, something like that. And then he would come into the lab, and then they would fMRI his, or MRI his brain, and he would be able to start one of these auras and then go through the full thing, including the pain with the migraine that ensued. So they got him to do this twice. The other two patients worked in the same building as the MRI machine, and so when they started to get one of these, they notified the lab immediately, and they went immediately to the MRI machine and had their brain scanned while their aura was going on. So, but that was caught like 10, 15 minutes later than the start. So what they were measuring is what's called blood oxygenation level dependent signal changes. So this is a measure of the amount of blood that's in the brain and how the brain is being activated. And what they saw was first an increase in this bold signal, and this is presumably due to a vasodilation. The blood vessels are presumably dilating and letting more blood into that region, which has got more activity. The bold change, the signal, propagated over the occipital cortex, that's where the visual cortex is located, at a speed of approximately 3.5 millimeters per minute, which is in the range of cortical spreading depression wave speed. This bold signal was also congruent with the movement of the visual person, with the person who was actually seeing. So they correlated these two things together and were able to say that this was in fact some evidence that the wave they were seeing was in fact related to the aura. And then the bold signal diminished, and this is presumably due to the fact that the blood vessels are constricting. Now, in the next picture, I'm going to actually show you a short video. And this is a video of a cortical spreading depression wave. And what I want to emphasize here is the vasodilation and constriction. And this is a video that was given to me by Andrew Charles at UCLA in the Department of Neurology. Now, I hope you can see it. It's a very faint thing. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to run it probably a couple times so you can see it. Did you see it?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to show it to you again. Let me see.
that from a human?
This is from a mouse. Okay, let me, I still don't know what that thing's all about. Okay, so first of all, this is the initial picture. Now, what's going to happen is there's going to be a stimulus up here, and then you'll see a very faint wavefront propagating down. And in particular, look at this particular blood vessel. And what you'll see is it will expand, and then it will contract as the wave goes by. And it won't be real fast. I mean, the wave will be fast, but the contraction will not be very fast. You see it? Let me play it again. So you can see how that really swells up and then contracts again. So that's one of the things that we're trying to look at now is, in fact, what the effect of cortical spray depression is on blood vessels themselves, because presumably that's involved in some of the headache. Okay, so now, what do you do about modeling this phenomenon? It's a very complex phenomenon because it involves the gross brain. It's not something that's at the cellular level. It involves the gross brain itself. So how do you do the modeling? Well, a long time ago after this was found, I think I skipped the slide here. There must have been a slide that was missing. This one. I forgot to show you this slide. I should say, this is A.A.P. Leal, who's a Brazilian neurophysiologist. Unfortunately, he died about 15 years ago. And he discovered CSD in his PhD thesis work in 1944 at Harvard when he was studying epilepsy in the rabbit. And this is what I told you about earlier, the depression of the EEG of 1 to 3 minutes. So these are EEG records. So 1-2 means that if you have these two electrodes together, then the relative difference in their electrical record is this. And you can see that there's normal activity, then it decreases, and then it stops. Here's the time scale, 1 minute. And this record continues down here. And you can see it slowly recovers back to where it was before. And now, so he was trying to study epilepsy, and he is a neurophysiologist who had this problem where you could generate this slow wave after an epileptic wave. Epileptic waves are generally very fast, but he would see the slow wave afterward, and that's why he decided to study this particular phenomenon instead. And so it's been known for 65 years, and we still don't really understand how it works. That's the reason it's such an interesting phenomenon. And a neurophysiologist, Charles Nicholson, has said, if you don't understand this phenomenon, you don't really understand the brain, which I think is true. And my philosophy about studying particular systems is the best way to study a system is to kick it really hard. And spraying cortical depression really kicks the brain hard, because it gets the brain into an abnormal range of parameter values. Okay, sorry, I had trouble with the... Okay. So, I forgot when it was, but around the time that this was found, then there were proposals for how to model this. And Wiener and Rosenbluth, Wiener is Norbert Wiener, the mathematician. Rosenbluth was a cardiologist from Mexico, and Shibata and Buresh also studied this. And what they did was they said, well, it's similar to what people have seen in cardiac muscle. So treat it as like a cellular automaton system and propagate waves around in the brain just like you do in cardiac muscle. The problem with that, of course, is that there's nothing in there with mechanisms. It's just, you know, set up an algorithm to do things, and so it's not very satisfactory from the modeling point of view. Bernice Grafstein, who was actually a PhD student at McGill, was the first to come up with the hypothesis that potassium was a major ion in this phenomenon. So your brain has a number of major chemicals, sodium, potassium, and chloride, as well as a bunch of other chemicals, and one of the important ones, of course, is calcium. And she said that she thought that the potassium increase on the extracellular space was a result of large numbers of action potentials in the brain. Whenever you have an action potential, what happens is that some potassium from inside the cells go outwards. And so if you have a whole bunch of these action potentials, then you could build up potassium in the extracellular part of the brain, and that this would then propagate as a wave. Now, the problem with that was that there was an experiment done by a group in Japan, Sugaya and his colleagues, who took a piece of tissue and who treated a certain part of the tissue with TTX, tetrodotoxin, which is the poison from the pufferfish, fugu. I don't know if you, for those of you who eat sashimi, Japanese food, fugu is something that is a real delicacy in Japan, but you could get a slight tingling in your mouth if you take it a little bit too seriously, I guess, because it could kill you. And so what they did was they took this piece of tissue, treated it in the middle so there are no action potentials. TTX will prevent action potentials from happening. You then start a wave on one side, you start it off and it runs into this region, treated region, but it actually came out the other side. And therefore, her hypothesis that action potentials were necessary was not true. Okay. So Henry Tuckwell and I, back in the late 1970s, came up with what we thought was what we called the neurotransmitter hypothesis, namely, how can you get large amounts of potassium in the extracellular space if you don't have action potentials? And it turns out that if you have a large amount of potassium in the extracellular space, this will then depolarize membranes so that more, you'll release neurotransmitters, and that neurotransmitters will then release more potassium in the extracellular space. And then this will propagate along. And that's what I'm going to describe to you today to show you the kind of setup that we used. And then we're now in the process, Fuxiong and Wei Yao and I are now in the process of modifying those problems to try to get something that's more reasonable. More recently, I should mention that this work was done in the late 70s, and after we published this one paper, we decided that was it. We already had the answer. But since then, no one has tried to do that experiment that we suggested. And in 2000, 2001, there were some papers written that talked about completely different mechanisms for this phenomenon. And so that's a reason that I sort of got back into this area again, because I don't really understand how this thing works right now. So this is a work by Shapiro, who's a PhD student at the Department of Biomathematics at UCLA. And then these are Codger et al. Codger and Wadman are from Germany. And then their senior colleague is Sonkin, who retired from Duke University. So here's a setup of what this is. This is the one that Tuckwell and I sort of came up with. So here's a cell, a neuron. So this upper region is called the dendrite. This region down here is called the cell body or soma. And there's an intracellular space. There's a membrane around it. And the outside space here is the extracellular space. And there are terminals. This is a very simplified picture. There are axons that come from other cells that feed into this particular neuron. And they come in and they form what are called synapses with this neuron, which we now call postsynaptic neuron. So this whole region here is called the synapse. You say synapse in Canada? Synapse? I can't remember. This is the presynaptic terminal. There's a little gap here called the synaptic cleft, and then there may or may not be some spines on this side or other receptors on this side for the neurotransmitter. And so what happens is that an action potential could come down here, release neurotransmitter from the presynaptic terminal, those diffuse across this cleft, attach to receptors on this side, and then you can get release of other ions there. So it's a this model that we're talking about here is a neurotransmitter model. Now, if you don't have action potentials, you can still get neurotransmitter release by simply putting in huge amounts of potassium in the extracellular space, because large amounts of potassium in the extracellular space will depolarize this membrane, which is what an action potential does. And by depolarization of this membrane, you will then be able to have, you'll have calcium moving in, and then neurotransmitter will come out. So that's the basic model that that Tuckwell and I had. And I should point out that in the picture I drew, I had earlier of the cortex, the wave is going in, this is the direction of the wave. Presumably the surface of the cortex is up here someplace. And so this is sort of just a schematic of what this looks like. Now what I want to do is then translate this into some mathematical model, and we're going to choose a continuum model. Now, you should really derive this somehow from individual neurons to a continuum. But the way we did it was we said, let's treat this as a, in plasma physics, there's something called a two-bag model. That means you treat the electrons and the positrons, or maybe three-bag model with the neutrons, in as three separate things in the same area, same region. So that's what this is going to look like. So here, one location here is X. But there are two regions. There's an extracellular space, and there's an intracellular space. And they should be thought of as overlapping. Now, what it really means is that if you go in and take an electrode, and you go in and measure what's there, if you happen to hit an extracellular point, then presumably that's up here somewhere. If you happen to go inside a cell, then presumably you're down here someplace. Okay? But they're not, these are not necessarily connected together.
Should we think of this as a bicontinuous media that's topologically wrapped up into one another?
That's what it is in reality, but in order to come up with a model, this is the way we're going to do it. Okay, so we're thinking of this as, think of this as all overlaid on, say, a one-dimensional axis. And at any given point, you have an extracellular space and an intracellular space, okay? And the idea here is that the extracellular space is completely connected. That's part of your topologically wrapped stuff. And so there's diffusion in here in addition to movement of ions across the membranes. And in the intracellular space, however, if you have one cell here, another cell here, then ions from this cell will not diffuse into this cell, but it has to go extracellular first, then diffuse, then go into the next cell. So the reason for these little barriers here is that there's no diffusion in this direction. There could be diffusion in this direction if you put a second dimension in, but not in this direction. Okay. So you'll see in the equation that there's only diffusion in the extracellular space, not in the intracellular space. And so ions are going to move in and out, and presumably extracellular potassium will be large, and then it will then propagate in this direction. Okay. So the idea is, how do you model this in order to get this kind of propagation? So this is a model that Tuckwell and I came up with this neurotransmitter mechanism. I'm not going to go into this in a lot of detail because in some sense right now we're not even focusing on that issue. It I think is a mechanism that's there, but it's not something that I really want to go into detail about. What I want to do though is tell you something about what the equations look like. And so for here, we only looked at two things. We looked at potassium and we looked at calcium. Potassium because that seems to be the major ion involved. Calcium because that seems to be what triggers the neurotransmitter release. Later on, calcium is not going to play a role at all for what we're doing. Okay, so what does it look like? Well, these are just nonlinear diffusion equations. Here is a time variation of the extracellular concentration of potassium. All right. There's a diffusion coefficient for potassium, and diffusion coefficient for potassium, by the way, is the same as an aqueous solution. Nothing special about that. Here is the second derivative term for the diffusion. And then here are two types of movements across the membrane. These are membrane ion currents, and I'll write these down a little bit more explicitly later. So these are membrane ion currents, and these are energy-consuming pumps. So in order for the ions to move back and forth and to be in equilibrium, then presumably at equilibrium, this thing has to equal zero. Okay. Now, for the intercellular space, you get the same thing, except I said no diffusion, remember? I said we're not putting any diffusion in the intracellular compartments. And there's this coefficient here which takes into account the fact that the extracellular space and the intracellular space are not of equal volume. So when an ion goes from one space to the other space, you have to take into account the volume change. And that's what this term is all about. Now, we work with extracellular space being about 20%. And you'll see that more recently, the value we're looking at is closer to between 10 and 15%. So, okay. And then the same thing occurs for calcium. And this is going to be minus infinity, infinity, and T greater than zero. So now it's strictly a PDE system with two equations happen to be ODEs. And this is in a very old paper, a biophysical journal paper by Tuckwell and myself, 1978. Okay, so does everyone understand? We've converted this really discrete medium into some continuum. And these are the governing equations. System of nonlinear diffusion equations. If you take those equations and you solve them numerically, then here's what you get. You get, you put in a big bolus of potassium here, and you let it go. This is time t equals 0. This is time t equals 16, t equals 32, and you can see it looks like a spreading depression wave. It looks like the wave I showed you from the experimental record, except here this is in space. And this is in millimeters. Here's the calcium. The extracellular calcium is 1 in this case. And intracellular calcium, by the way, is very low, extremely low concentrations. And this also sort of follows that. Okay. So here is a case where we can get, we have a model, and we can basically reproduce the waves that come out. And we've only taken into account two of the ions, so potassium and calcium. Remember, there's also sodium and chloride. So even though we get the right behavior, we still have to worry about the other ions. Furthermore, here I say, note the shape and speed are approximately correct. This is about 1 millimeter per minute, which is in the range of measurements of 1 to 15 millimeters per minute for spreading depression. Now, the however here has nothing to do with the fact that we've left out sodium and chloride. What I want to emphasize is the modeling. Even if you can find a model that will reproduce the wave and give you the right speed and the right shape, doesn't mean that's the correct model. You could have just come up with things to make it do what you wanted it to do. If you really want to understand the basic phenomena, then you want to know what the mechanisms are. And if you start putting in the mechanisms, then hopefully you'll be able to reproduce not only the shape and the speed, but you'll be able to predict other things that weren't originally put into the model. Okay? So it's a philosophical question, but I think an important one from the modeling point of view. A lot of people will model things and then come up with saying, oh yeah, this looks exactly like the data, and therefore we must be right. May not be right. And in fact, there is no such thing, as far as I know, of actually completely validating a model. It is always possible that you can do another experiment and something else will come out of it. Okay. Okay, now, more recently, this is work by Kadri Wadman and Samjan in 2000. And what they did was the following. They decided, which is was completely, I would say, counterintuitive, rather than looking at this gross phenomenon, they said, let's look at one cell and see what it does during spreading depression. So they took this cell. This is when I wrote this, this is neuron. It's all in capital letters because there's a program called neuron. And that's what they use to do their computations. And the neuron is actually quite an extensive program. It's being used by a lot of people. And they have a huge database that has many different kinds of cells in them. And they give you the morphology, and they give you lots of details about the structure and so forth. So if you want to do detailed calculations, then this is one place you can do it and get pictures and so forth. So what they did was they said, okay, we're going to do a neuron calculation on a single cell. This is a, I think it's a CA1 hippocampal cell. And they decided, well, they would break it up into two pieces, the soma, the cell body, and the dendrite. And they put in a whole bunch of currents. The exact nature of all these currents isn't so important. What's important is that they have these currents going in and out. They have intracellular ion concentrations for two of the ions, potassium and sodium, and extracellular concentrations of those two ions. So those are the two ions that they were focusing on. Here they took the interstitial space, the extracellular space, as 15% of the cell volume. So the cell volume is, I had originally thought it was 80% of the total volume, but whatever volume it is, the extracellular space is 15% of that volume. Okay? Does everyone understand? Okay. And then they put in a bunch of currents, and I'll write those down a little bit more completely in a little bit. And what they then did was they stimulated this cell with an electric current, and they asked the question, what's going to happen as you stimulate this soma? So here's the kind of pictures they came up with. This is time in seconds. So this is simply this little part right here. You can see the stimulus bar, and there's a little stimulus bar. That's the same bar. These are just two different time scales on the axes. So what you see is when they stimulate it, you can see that it produces action potentials. And these action potentials, they stimulate it for a certain length of time, then they shut it off, and the action potentials continue, and then they eventually go down, and then this is the membrane potential. And then they look at what happens to these other things. This is the extracellular, this is the Nernst potential for potassium and the Nernst potential for sodium. I'll tell you what those are in a minute. I'll give you formulas for those. And you can see that the Nernst potential for potassium slowly increases, the Nernst potential for sodium slowly decreases. And then you can see the longer time records. And these are the concentrations that they calculated along the way. And this is all done with neuron. Okay, so I'm not going to say any more about the specific data they got. So here's the actual equations they are currents that they put in. And what we want to come up with is a simpler version of their model. Rather than using neuron, which takes into account very detailed information about the cell, it's got, I forgot how many, 200 something compartments in it. We're trying to do something much simpler and see whether we can come out with the same results that they got. So, first of all, this is the spatially independent case. Spatially independent in the sense of X, as I had initially. And so these are just ODEs. Here's the membrane potential equation. This is the capacitive current term. It's equal to minus all of the currents that are involved in this particular problem. And they only considered sodium and potassium, And so this I is really a sum of these four terms. This is the sodium current, the total sodium current, total potassium current, leak current, I'll tell you about that in a minute, and then a stimulation current. So the sodium current, it consists of all these things. So this is what's called the fast transient sodium current, the persistent sodium current, the NMDA sodium current, the leak current, and the pump. The pump is very important because if you don't put the pump in, things don't go back to where they were initially. Same thing for the potassium. Here's a delayed rectifier current, this is the, which potassium current is this? Is this slow potassium current? I can't remember. NMDA current. The NMDA current, these currents here are associated with the neurotransmitter. And they're sort of a non-specific kind of current. I should have mentioned, the membrane is filled with these proteins that are channels. And some of the channels are specific to specific ions. And so these currents are currents that are going through these particular channels. And the NMDA channels are non-specific. That means sodium and potassium goes through those channels. Whereas this is only for sodium. These channels only allow sodium through. These channels only allow potassium through. And then there's a leak current, and then there's pump currents for each of those. And then the overall leak current in addition to these two leak currents, and then stimulation current. These leak currents are what are sometimes referred to as passive currents because the conductance of the channel doesn't change as you change membrane potential. You also need those in order to make sure everything comes back to equilibrium in the rest state. Now there are two kinds of representations of these currents, and so these particular so-called active currents, active in this case means that the conductance can change as a function of voltage. They have this form, what's called the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz representation. And so this is the contribution from the membrane potentials and, in fact, from the ion concentrations, both extracellular and intracellular. This is the membrane potential. Phi is simply a constant equal to RT over ZF. R is the gas constant, T is the temperature in Kelvin, Z is the valence, and F is the Faraday constant. And there's some coefficients out here in front. These two terms here, if some of you are familiar with Hodgkin-Huxley, these are the so-called activation and inactivation coefficients. These numbers, M and N, vary between 0 and 1. And the powers P and Q depends on which particular ion current we're talking about, and also the kinetics of the M and the N depend on the particular channel we're talking about. So it's a very complicated system of ODEs in this case. We're not taking into account spatial dependence in here. So those are for these particular currents. For the leak currents here, we use what's called the standard Hodgkin-Huxley currents. Namely, there's a coefficient, which is the conductance, which is fixed. And then this is driven by the difference between the membrane potential and what's called a Nernst potential. The Nernst potential is simply the following. If you have a membrane with ion concentration differences on the two sides, then you have what's called an electrochemical gradient. And the Nernst potential, which is given by this expression here, is simply the potential you need so that the net flux of ions across the membrane is zero. Okay, so if you look here, that means that if you were to change the membrane potential to the Nernst potential for this particular ion, then this term would be zero, and the current from that would be zero. There'd be zero driving force across the membrane. The last term here are the pumps, and here this is what's called the sodium-potassium electrogenic pump, exchange pump. And this takes, the idea of the pumps is to get the system back to where it was originally. So this is a 3 times I. I pump is just this term here. But 3 means that 3 sodium ions go out whenever two potassium ions go in. Or rather, I should say, three sodium ions go out and two potassium ions go in. So they're trying to recover back to where they were originally. Okay, so that's a fairly complicated description of what this stuff is all about, but it's basically the membrane potential depends on the movement of ions across the membrane. That's what's important. Okay? Now, if you just have spreading depression, that occurs on the scale of seconds, then this term here is not really very important. The capacitive current is really important on the order of milliseconds. But when you're talking about action potentials being in the system, then this term becomes important. Okay? So if you do that, and then now you add in the equations for the ion concentrations, because those are moving now, those are changing. If you're familiar with the Hodgkin-Huxley equations, the assumption in the Hodgkin-Huxley equations is that the ion concentrations are fixed. And for one action potential, that's essentially true. For 20 action potentials, that's essentially true. I don't know about 100, and I don't know about 1,000, but for small numbers of action potentials, the ion concentrations are basically fixed. Okay? But when you're now talking about movement of the membrane potential to values that are not near rest, then these currents here are no longer going to be zero. They're not going to be near zero at all. So you're going to have all kinds of ion concentration changes occurring. And so here's some of the results. These are calculations done by Wei Yao and Hua Shang. And so you see. And I should have done something which I understand is capable here. Which is this one? No, it doesn't work.
I think it'll fix it when you go to the next slide.
But there's nothing to push here. And then there was that little thing that came up earlier.
Might project a screen on.
No, this is different laptop. Okay, anyway. Whoops. Now what? You pushed the button, I didn't push the button. Okay, let me try on here.
Begin presentation. Can you push this?
Yeah. Ah, okay. Yeah. Good. Okay. Okay. Watch this. This is great. Okay. So now, this is the experiments that were done by Codger et al. And these are the more recent. And you can see that there's a strong similarity between them. They're not going to be exactly the same. There's a strong similarity between these two. And this is from a much simpler calculation. The calculation done by Codger et al. Using Neuron requires many more calculations than what we've done here. So the idea is to try to get a simpler version of the model that will allow us to do more detailed calculations later on. Okay. So these are, I don't know if you can read them or not, but this is basically the action potentials that you see over here. And then in addition, there are ion concentrations and Nernst potentials. And you could compare these two if you wanted to. I'm not going to do that. Okay. Now, these equations are identical to the ones I had before. The only difference is this is now a partial differential instead of an ordinary differential term. And so everything else is exactly the same. And then if you want to put in space, then you want to put in diffusion. And that's this, that's these two extra terms here, this one and this one. So if you add those in, then here, for example, is an example of a calculation of the extracellular potassium concentration. And this is in milliseconds. And you can see each of these lines corresponds to a single cell. So here's a bunch of cells that are lined up, and we want to understand how the stimulation of two or three cells at one end leads to propagation of this phenomenon. And so this is, these are preliminary results, I should say. Okay, so should take them with a grain of salt at this point. And so each of these corresponds to a separate cell, and you can see that you get very similar behavior, and this thing is going to start to propagate as you go to the right. Okay. Oh, I'm over my time. I'm sorry. This is the corresponding picture for the membrane potential. This is a 2D picture, and this is a corresponding 3D picture. These I just got from Washong last night. So you've seen the hot latest stuff. But there's still a lot to be done in terms of really trying to make sure that we understand what's going on here and making sure that the calculations have been done correctly. Okay, now there are other things, I've run out of time, but there are other things that have been done and other mechanisms that are important, we believe. One of them is called spatial buffering. And it's a very simple idea, which I'd like to explain. It's a little complicated for explaining, but I think it's actually not that difficult. Here is a cell, and this is extracellular space. Suppose you dump in a whole bunch of potassium here. Spatial buffering is, well, let me tell you why we're interested in this. The speed I told you was 1 millimeter per minute. The experimental range is 1 to 15 millimeters per minute. How do you get the variation? You can't change the diffusion coefficient. The terms that I've put in, you can't change. So the question is, what can you change? And here's a possible mechanism that can change things. So if you put a large amount of potassium here, I'd like to be able to change the speed at which the potassium from here gets to there. That's sort of what we're looking at, the speed of the potassium wave. Okay, here's the way to do it if you do what's called spatial buffering. If you increase the amount of potassium here, then what happens is it depolarizes membrane here. Potassium ions go into the cell. When it goes into the cell, as I said, there's a depolarization of membrane here. This membrane, this is for the people who know what I'm talking about, so if you don't understand what I'm talking about, you can take a rest now. So here's a membrane potential here that has been depolarized. By electrotonic spread, that moves very quickly to the other side. When that moves to the other side, then the ion concentration on the two sides are the same as before, but the membrane potential has changed. The effect of doing that is potassium in the inside moves to the outside. And that's what's called spatial buffering. And it moves very quickly compared to just the diffusion. Okay? So that's one mechanism we're going to try to incorporate. Another, of course, is very important is that the volume actually changes. The volume of the extracellular space changes. It shrinks. And so to do that, you have to take into account what's called osmosis. This is the movement of water across the membrane. And so if you look at the extracellular space during CSD, it's compressed about 25 to 50% of its original volume fraction, which is quite a bit. And so cell swelling due to this osmotic movement of water across the membrane, that's the reason for this change. And as I said, all of these ions are moving across the membrane, but because it's moving across the membrane, you lose isotonicity. Okay, and the cell likes to maintain isotonicity, the same number of solutes on the inside and outside. And so as a result, water is going to move to try to change the volumes. And the result of that is that there will be an increase in the size of a cell, and that will then lead to the shrinkage of the extracellular space. So this is an important mechanism, but requires that you put into the equations conditions for isotonicity, of course, electroneutrality, and the fact that there are certain ions that are trapped inside the cell. They don't go across the membrane. Okay, so those are two important mechanisms. I was going to tell you about other things that we've already done, but I won't do that. So let me just summarize. I've told you a little bit about migraine with aura. At least I hope you understand it better and you will have more sympathy for your friends who happen to have this. I told you about cortical spreading depression, when it was discovered, what its characteristics are, and then the connection between these two, between migraine with aura and cortical spreading depression. I've told you about models that have been proposed for spreading depression, and what we're trying to do is still really try to understand the mechanisms involved in this phenomenon. If we can understand those mechanisms, then maybe we can say something about treatment for this particular disease, migraine. I've told you details about the continuum modeling approach that we've taken. I should mention that we've also in the past done work using cellular automata methods called the lattice-Boltzmann method, lattice gas, if you know about that. And that, unfortunately, requires very detailed structural information about the cells. And so from a computational point of view, it's a very large computation that's going to require very, very fast computers. Newer models by Samjin and his colleagues, and how we're trying to take some of their results and extend them into spatial propagation models. I told you what spatial buffering is and the osmotic problem, and I want to thank you for your attention. Thank you very much.
First question is, Professor Yurek, shall these presentations be available for download?